And tonight we begin Who's Behind the Secret Door? Three special guests, one each hour, and I've got to guess who that person may be. And eventually, I'll hopefully get the answer so we can conduct the interview. And then we'll take calls at the half on each half hour as well. But three special guests. Most of them are Coast to Coast regulars, so depending on how they try to trick me, I have a pretty good chance of figuring out who they are. But it's been running about 60-40 since we've been doing this, where I get about 60% of them. So we'll find out when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. So let me tell you how we do this. I try to guess who's behind the secret door. If I'm right, we go on with the rest of our interview. If I'm wrong, and I'll try a couple times, they'll eventually tell me who they are, and we'll conduct the interview as well. We will take calls at the half with you and the secret guest as well, and we've got three special guests for the rest of the show tonight. So let's open up the door for the first secret guest. Well, hello there. Come on in. And how are you?
I'm doing fine.
No, that's interesting. Have you been a Coast guest often?
I have.
You have. You're giving me a little Irish accent, aren't you?
It's not Irish, it's Scottish.
But you're not Irish, are you?
Not Irish, Scottish.
Scottish. Okay, you're right. I heard it. As a matter of fact, you sound a little like Mel Gibson in Braveheart.
Freedom.
That's very good. Okay, let me ask you your expertise. Are you into the paranormal, the conspiracies, alternative medicine? What is it?
Ancient civilizations believed that the planet Earth was hollow.
That is got to be my very special friend. Gosh, you run a truck company too, don't you? Are you there?
Occasionally.
Uh-huh. It's Brooks Agnew, isn't it?
That it is.
I knew it. And you know how I finally guessed this?
No.
When you said hollow, that was it.
Get out.
Plus, I run a promo of you every night that people on hold hear that you did with me a couple years ago. How are you?
I'm doing great. Way busier than I want to be, that's for sure.
Well, and you also did a great BeyondBelief.com television show with us.
That was great. I have a face for radio, you did a good job.
So tell me more about the Hollow Earth, Brooks. What's going on there?
Well, there has been some new data, and it's quite amazing, actually. The scientific expeditions that have been done in space and also the exploration of the core of the Earth using spectroscopy. Some really very cool breakthroughs have been done, and it's really going to rewrite the way that we think planets form. Because one of the things the Japanese did, and then another lab, Carnegie Labs, they began measuring the frequencies that are coming out of the center of the Earth with very sensitive equipment. And what we realize in chemistry is that every single element has a certain, let's just call it a musical note. And we have them all cataloged, iron and sodium and everything. And what we realized is that we were getting a signal out of the center of the Earth that explained, it solved a question that we have about our atmosphere. Our atmosphere is supposed to have a certain amount of xenon in it, just because of mm-hmm. the law of partial pressures. But the xenon is missing. I mean a lot of it, like 80% of the xenon is missing from our atmosphere that we expect to be there. And the frequency that they're getting out of the center of the Earth is actually iron, which doesn't surprise anybody, but it's iron matrixed with xenon. And the only way that can happen is if the center of the Earth is actually one giant iron crystal.
Now, This the center of the Earth planet, of course, has got a lot of people in controversy, Brooks. You know, ever since Admiral Byrd claimed that he went through the center of the Earth, but he, first of all, what do you think of Byrd's story, Admiral Byrd's story?
Well, the original story where he put his plane on the deck of the Chantilly, which he leased, and sailed up to Spitsbergen, offloaded the plane onto the rocky shore, put the plane back together and flew it ostensibly 2,500 miles over the North Pole and back at about 3,000 feet altitude, which is why he's an aviation hero instead of a statistic. There was a lot of controversy about that because he arrived back a little early, and that actual route was duplicated a couple times in subsequent years, and they didn't do it as quickly, and they didn't see what he saw. So there was some controversy about that. But I think the controversy you're referring to is the alleged Byrd diary.
Yes.
And I went through that diary very carefully. I looked at several documentaries that Byrd was featured in on television, and the way that he spoke and the way that he wrote. And my determination was that the diary that was circulating was a fraud.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So
how disappointing.
He never flew into the Earth, at least according to my analysis. And he didn't meet any, you know,
strange beings.
Yeah. His plane wasn't taken with a tractor beam, you know, into an opening in the Earth. And a lot of people wanted to believe that, and it certainly circulated like it was believable. But, you know, I'm a scientist. I'm looking for data. I need to classify all of the information. And some of it, I got to admit, you know, pretty convincing stories,
sure,
but no validation.
The original movie, Journey to the Center of the Earth, that starred our friend Pat Boone, is that a possibility like that?
It is a possibility if you fall into it, because we're talking about a crust that's about 800 or 900 miles thick. So if you're going to walk into it, you know, with nothing but a backpack, it's going to take you about 3.5 months. And that's if you walk briskly every day. And I don't think you can carry 3.5 months worth of food and water. And that's going to just take you one way. It's 3.5 months out as well. I just don't think it's feasible unless you fall into, you know, some kind of vent, or unless you find some place where the crust is very thin, like the possibility that may exist at the North Pole.
Now, a couple of years ago, I think you were planning on going on a Russian ice cutter ship. Whatever happened to that, and is that still a possibility?
Well, that was more than a couple, George.
Yeah, 13, I know. I'm being kind.
Almost 13 years ago. Well, what we planned to do in 2008, the summer of 2008, was to take the Russian icebreaker, the Yamal. We were going to charter the ship, put 100 scientists, filmmakers, documentarians on that ship, break ice for 8 days, see if we could find this opening and document it and let the world know. But the summer of 2008, the economy had something else in mind. So we did not raise the money to do that in 2008. So we tried various methods after that. We made a pilot film. We did several GoFundMes. We toured the world. I spoke to over 100,000 people live trying to promote that event. I spent, well, I don't want to tell you what I spent. It was a lot of money. But you know, we're talking almost a $4 million venture by the time you lease the ship, transport all the scientists to the ship, make the venture, and then do the post-production on the film, you know, to even get it where people could watch it. And there just wasn't that kind of money available. So that being said, we are working with a company out of Australia that is interested in revisiting this. And there's a new ship that was built last year called the Arctica. And it is really, really a sweet vessel. holds 125 people, and it can definitely do the trip. In fact, I think it's the only ship on the planet that can make this venture.
Have you had any network interest, like the History Channel or anything like that? Because this would be an amazing program.
Oh, it would make Deadliest Catch look like, you know, Gilligan's Island.
Sure would.
Yeah. We met with History Channel, Discovery Channel, Nat Geo Channel, Science Channel, and they were all willing to air the documentary, but none of them would even let us use their logo in the fundraising.
Ah. Now, were they willing to pay you for the documentary once it was done?
They would do it on an episode-by-episode basis.
Okay.
So what we wanted to do was run 3,000 hours of film live.
That's a lot.
Well, it's, you know, 10 cameras running 24 hours a day. You can accumulate a lot of live reality show film. But what we were going to do is upload that in packets. Every 2 hours the satellite comes over, we would upload the packets of data to the satellite, and then it would download to web servers, and then people would get an almost live shot of everything that's going on the ship. And we thought if we could sell subscriptions to that, we could earn some of the money back.
What keeps driving you on this project, Brooks? You won't give up.
I never give up. You know, there's only two kinds of engineers in the world, George. There are starters and there are finishers. And Lord knows we wouldn't be anywhere without the starters. I'm grateful for them, but I'm a finisher. And I don't not having an unfinished project.
You also like to win, knowing you.
Well, I'm only in competition with myself, so you're right. I always come through. I always finish. I always solve the problem. And even if it takes me another 5 years to do this, I'll do it with my own money.
Brooks Agnew, our special guest. He was our first Behind the Secret Door guest. I guessed who he was. We're going to take calls with Brooks at the half. So get your questions ready as we're talking primarily about the hollow earth. What else are you working on these days?
Well, you know that I wrote those four books in 2 years, and one of them incorporates the hollow earth into the story. The Birth Trilogy has really, really been selling well, and I've been touring the country signing books.
Good for you.
And I think we're going to make the trilogy into a TV series. So that's what I'm working on right now as my future project.
That's exciting. That is exciting indeed. And did you ever think 20, 25 years ago you'd be doing this today?
I've been writing and publishing since I was 15 years old, but I never thought I'd write books. I thought I would always write articles. And then when I was 52 years old, those of you people out there that think you can't start something late in life, I was 52 years old, I wrote my first book. And in fact, that's what launched my other career and what got me on your program way back in 2005.
Yeah. Exactly. And what a great show that was, too. And you've always done a great job, Brooks. I mean, you handle yourself with the media in a very professional, great way, but people understand you and you make things exciting.
Well, science should be exciting, I think. People that lose faith in exploration and in solving problems, and in especially with energy and living within the environment and maybe even, you know, progressing in their own lives. The solutions are in science, and we're finding them. And it's, I've worked almost exclusively with the Fortune 100 for almost 20 years. I don't much work with small companies, but I have, and they benefit from exactly the same mathematical systems that I put together for the giants. It works.
So the hollow earth theory, of course, that you have carried with you all these years, how far deep in to the planet do you think it goes?
Well, the deepest hole that we officially will admit to is about 8 miles, and it's in Russia, and it's an oil well. It's the deepest well in the world. There are rumors out there of underground military bases that go down 40, 50, 60 miles into the planet.
Jeez.
But I don't have any direct data of that. In fact, I was talking with one of my partners yesterday, and we were talking about maybe taking some of the coordinates that are being published out there for the openings into some of these deep underground military bases and going there ourselves and photographing it ourselves instead of taking the publicly available images on the internet, and just see if any of this is true, if we really are exploring deep into the planet.
Were some of these natural, or were they all man-made?
The report is that they're all man-made, and they're made with a giant tunneling machine. I've seen, there are some pictures of it out there on the internet. Of course, I guess this thing doesn't come to the surface very often. And that this thing is, you know, powered by some incredible power source. And we were having a spirited discussion about this today. I said, what do they do with all the dirt? I mean, we're talking enough dirt to make a mountain.
You can't hide that. Jeez.
Yeah, well, they said, well, the dirt disintegrates as this machine goes forward. And I said, I'm not buying it. You can't take dirt and just not turn it into something. It's got to turn into energy or something. There'd be a signature somewhere. So I just don't like it when people make unsubstantiated claims. So I'm going to go find out for myself.
Brooks, people all around this country have been talking about or hearing a very low hum, and it's driving people who hear it crazy. And might that be digging deep within the planet?
It could be. You know, I've listened to some of these recordings, and you're right. This is a very low frequency, and some people can hear it and some people can't. And it is localized. It's not universal. It appears in some places and then not in other places. But I don't know if you remember Patrick Flanagan, but he did a lot of work on what we call constructive interference with sound. And what we have found is that low-level sounds, which can't be heard in one place, can mount up on one another. We call it resonation. And they can be heard very well in other places. And it's just the way the waves go around the planet through the air. They constructively interfere with one another, they resonate, and then the sound appears. The question on everyone's mind is, what's making the sound? This is down in the 20 to 40 hertz range, which you're a sound guy. You know, that's almost out of the range of hearing. It's almost what a subwoofer would pick up. But some people with good hearing can pick up that sound. And there's another sound that kind of sounds a little bit like a trumpet, like almost like metal, you know, scraping.
But that sounds biblical.
Yeah. Mm. And I've heard the recordings of that, and it's just eerie. And some of the recordings are in places like Alaska, where there's no equipment or anything for 50 miles, and yet you hear this sound. It almost sounds like a piece of steel being, you know, dragged down the road. It's quite incredible.
Well, then again, Brooks, how do we know it's not biblical? You know, the trumpets are sounding, and God knows what's happening. Literally.
I bet he does, yeah. You know, some of the energy that comes in from the sun, which we have not had the benefit of this solar cycle, I must say, some of that energy can have harmonics in the audible range. That is to say, we can hear it with our ears. And that would sound like a trumpet.
That would sound
like, you know, a sound in the 600 to 700 hertz range.
Well, stay with us. We're going to open up the phone lines now and give you an opportunity to talk with our first Behind the Secret Door guest, Brooks Agnew, as we talk about the Hollow Earth. We will be back in a moment with your questions on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you, along with Brooks Agnew, our first Secret Door guest, and we're talking about the Hollow Earth. Brooks, so you're not saying there's a huge hole at the top of the North Pole, right?
It doesn't look like that is the case. It looks like it may be a vent in the sea floor. You got to understand the ocean is about 4,400 meters deep where we're looking. And so it's doubtful that there is a, you know, tunnel going down through all of that water to, you know, at the inside of the planet. But based on a survey that was done of rays, and I mean stingrays and manta rays in Malaysia, they do this every few years. It looks like the large opening that occurred in the ice in 2008-2009. We had a very warm winter that year in the Arctic, and a big piece of ice broke off. And right after that, they discovered 1,500 new species of rays that had appeared suddenly in our ocean. And it was right after that that Washington University published their finding that there is another body of water the size of the Arctic Ocean underneath the Atlantic Ocean, inside the crust. So we think that there may be a large vent that connects these inner and outer oceans, and that the sea life was actually swimming between the oceans, and it managed to make it into the Gulf Stream because of the opening when that ice broke loose.
Interesting. To the phones we go. Sean, first time caller, Annapolis, Maryland. Hey, Sean, thanks for calling.
Hey, I'm also an insider. I work in TV and film, and I work on historical projects, and I crisscross the East Coast of the United States. And
well, good for you.
To have coast available for those long drives.
Super.
So I was calling. He was talking about the resonance of sound, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but the Battle of Antietam during the Civil War covered an area of 5.078 miles, I believe it is. There were over 500 cannon firing about 3,000 rounds an hour for 12 hours, and there were entire regiments that had no idea there was a battle going on, and they were within that five-mile cone. So the temperature, they did some research into it, and did a brief documentary about it, and it was the heat of the day caused the sound to react differently. And so if it hadn't been so hot, those people might have been in a zone where they could hear it. So I totally get that resonance with regards to affecting the sound carry. And, one night it's there, and the next night it might not be there because of a temperature shift or something along those lines. But fascinating conversation tonight.
Great. Thank you, Sean. That's interesting, Brooks, isn't it?
Yeah. Sound does that. It will be vacant in one place, and then it'll add on to itself in another place. So maybe those cannons were not heard within that 5 square miles, but it's quite possible 40 miles away, those long waves, those concussions from the cannons may have made it as much as 40 miles away, and someone 40 miles away could have heard that battle where someone 5 miles away could not.
You know, if you get this opportunity to go and look for some of these, can we call them caverns? Is that an accurate thing?
Yeah, caverns. In the press, they call them deep underground military bases, or DUMs.
Who would have them? Us, the Russians, Chinese?
Depends on whose property they're on.
Yeah.
Hopefully the ones that are on our property in New Mexico. And I read recently of one that may exist right on the West Coast, and it's large enough that submarines can navigate into this opening and make their way all the way to the east border of California. I mean, that's a long, long way underground, especially for a submarine. It's got to be very, very big. This is a tremendous claim, and sounds like something that would be pretty easy to verify if they'll let us in. Hopefully, we don't have an enemy that has a military base underneath our country.
Let's hope not. Let's go to Bill, State of Washington. Hi, Bill. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, hey. I'll be straight up honest with you. I do hear what you describe as the trumpet sound.
Mm-hmm.
I hear it when I'm in Portland, but I live in the Seattle area. I don't ever hear it here. And also, I want to connect a couple of things that might be a little bit too disparate, but still, I can't help but wonder. They've had like a lot of discoveries along the Pacific coast, like in California. They had the Arlington Springs man. They had the Chiruti mastodon site. A lot of things are turning Clovis first theory on its head. And I've always been a big fan of the Bering incubation theory, because In other words, the Bering Sea may have been a continent above ground, okay, or above the water line. And that continent may have hosted a massive civilization. And that massive, the descendants of that massive civilization are the North American natives, you know, native North American tribes, okay, and maybe even South America for that matter. But the bottom line is it's got me wondering about this, also a report in National Geographic, that the Juan de Fuca plate, it's a dead plate. It's, you know, we don't ever think about it, but some of these tectonic plates are like plants. They live and they die. And they're saying that there is a giant cavity under, from the Juan de Fuca dying, there's a giant cavity under Oregon. Have you ever thought about that or looked into that? Or is that something that is interesting to you?
Well said, Bill. What do you think, Brooks?
Well, yeah, we've looked into the Juan de Fuca plate. And, you know, the strange thing about wars is it spawns new technology, at least of that era. And during World War II, we were so worried that enemy submarines would encroach upon our west coast.
Yes.
That they installed hydrophones on the bottom of the ocean, along the Juan de Fuca plate, as a matter of fact.
And that was a legitimate concern, too.
Sure, sure. Now, we never, as far as I know, picked up submarines, and we don't today, but they use the phones, and they've been listening to whale songs and all kinds of things. And one of the things that they discovered, this was not long ago, maybe 5 or maybe 8 years ago, because we were doing research trying to narrow down the area that we were going to go explore with this icebreaker, the hydrophones began picking up movement of magma underneath the Juan de Fuca plate. And when they analyzed this, they made a discovery that if the Juan de Fuca plate were to tilt suddenly, it would cause a tsunami.
It would probably take
out Portland.
Or Seattle.
Yeah.
We used to have a guest who's passed on, Stuart Wild, who was convinced that Seattle was going to get hit that way. Totally convinced. That's kind of scary. Wayne in Tacoma, Washington. Go ahead, Wayne.
Good evening, gentlemen. Sir George.
Hi there, Wayne.
Brooks. An FYI on that tunneling machine, that Air Force nuclear-powered tunneling machine was available. I don't know if it's still available to look at on the Internet, but according to some inside sources, they claim that could do anywhere from as little as 3 up to 30 miles of tunneling a day.
Wow.
Just quite amazing when you think about it. And it would take some of that dirt material and melt it to help cool the nuclear device. And they said they could super compact that and just make a smooth, round, like tubular tunnel with it. It's amazing when you think about it. Now, the question that I had was about the Nazi German submarine base in Antarctica, New Schwagenland, they called it. Have you ever looked into that? That was a very deep base that they were taking. The Nazis were taking prisoners from the prisons to begin with, and then in the very early parts of taking the Jews, they used slave labor of the Jews in those deep underground submarine bases. And what they did down there was even far greater than the one they built in the North Sea. So, and of course, there's other stories that go on to the extraterrestrial connection. But have you ever looked into that? And that would be probably the number one place I would want to look at when I first went down there.
Well, I haven't been to Antarctica, but I know Brad Olson pretty well. He spent 4 weeks on a trip down through South America and then took 14 days and took a small boat, like 70 feet. And they sailed from the tip of South America to Antarctica, and he tried to explore those very areas. And he did. It was in the summertime last year, or this last winter. And it's kind of amazing that they didn't discover the rumored findings that have been put out on the radio, I guess, the last couple of years about Antarctica. That doesn't mean that the Nazis didn't go down there. They did. And we don't know if they flourished or if they died out.
Right.
Some of the rumors are that there was a massive military operation called Operation High Jump to try to take them out, because it was only a couple years after World War II. And, you know, we still had ships and we had battle-hardened troops that were still regular Army and regular Navy. And, you know, there are controversy about that operation, if it even existed. So I don't really know what to tell you other than that.
And there's always been talk that they escaped after the war down there, too.
Well, they would have. I mean, they had the equipment. They had the best submarines.
Oh, they had great technology.
Yeah, and there was a lot of gold. There was fine art. I mean, every officer was every man for himself there the last probably 6-7 months of the war. And so they were loading up these submarines and taking their crews, and they probably went to Brazil and Argentina and places like that.
Oppenheimer and company, of course, did a great job doing what they did at Los Alamos. But how in the world did we beat the Germans to getting that nuke?
Well, of course, my undergraduate degree is in nuclear chemistry, and
mm-hmm.
I know the industry pretty well. I would say we didn't. What we did is we confiscated all the work that they had done. In fact, it's pretty well decided now that the trigger that we used on the first bomb was actually a German trigger.
Really?
Yeah. We actually did not know how to trigger the bomb. We took the trigger from their research base, and that's the trigger we used.
Did they have a bomb developed and they just didn't use it?
They had the trigger device, which is the implosion device that actually makes the fissile material go critical. But they did not have the technology yet to make the fissile material. That's what we did in Chicago.
Wow. God was with us on that one, Brooks.
We just missed it.
Yep. We really did. Let's go to Mark and go ahead.
Then we blew up 2,600 more of them around the world.
Yeah. Mark in Florida. Go ahead, Mark.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen. Mr. Norrie.
Hi, Mark.
Yes, I wanted to ask you something. First of all, yeah, I was thinking about what you were saying about subs off the coast of California. I'm assuming probably Japanese subs, and I know my pop told me, and he was a Navy man like you, George, we had German subs off the coast of Florida,
we
right?
We sure did. Your dad was absolutely right.
And he does that as a little boy. I mean, he grew up in Coral Gables, and he heard the stories. What I wanted to ask you guys was, and Tommy remembers, George, I can't remember if it was your show or Art Bell's, but I wanted to ask Mr. Agnew, and by the way, I think your Scottish accent was spot on, lad. It was excellent. I was like, who is that guy? You know, I don't remember him, but anyway. What I wanted to ask you was real quick, what do you think about the whole, and Tommy remembers, I don't know why this is coming to my head.
Mel's Hole, you're talking about. Mel's Hole. And that was
Right. Can you tell me, that's the one that we heard that they thought the sounds from hell were coming. Where is that, Siberia, or was that same thing where you said the oil was being drilled in?
No, Mel's Hole, I think, was in the state of Washington. Brooks, I don't know if you were ever a part of that. Were you?
No, I wasn't a part of that. But the sounds that were actually recorded and put on the internet were actually debunked, because the sounds were taken and they were found somewhere else. And it was actually a recording that was made of something else.
It actually, to me, sounded like people rushing around during a Black Friday after Thanksgiving at a store going crazy. But Brooks, I want to thank you for being on the program. Give out your website for folks who still want to track what you do.
Sure, absolutely. It's brooksagnew.com, brooksagnew.com. And don't forget, I'll be at Contact in the Desert in May.
I will be there with you, my friend. I'll see you then.
All right, thank you.
Brooks Agnew was our very first Who's Behind the Secret Door, and I got it right. So up next, we've still got two more of them. One more next hour, one more in our last hour of the show. We'll still have your phone calls with our guests at the half of each one, so stick with us. And they're just great people. I just don't know who they are. I have to guess, but I'm one for one so far. So we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with another Who's Behind the Secret Door.